Thank you, Margo. I've chosen this morning to approach our topic, Reclaiming the Moral Foundations, in the manner of Speaker Gingrich. That is, to recommend that you read at least two recent books that contribute mightily to achieving our task of renewing American civilization. It's a great honor for me to share the platform with two very distinguished scholars, Dr. Evans and Dr. Alex Chofin. Almost a decade ago, Dr. Chofin published a brilliant study of the late scholastic economic theories, comparing them to the teachings of classical liberal economic theorists. Significantly, he anticipated our theme of reclaiming our moral foundations by titling his book, Christians for Freedom, Late Scholastic Economics. That's still in print from the Ignatius Press. And he concluded that the separation of modern economics from its Christian ethical roots would ultimately undermine both free market economics and the rights of property. Now, days before his untimely death in January, Murray Rothbard's long-awaited History of Economic Thought was published. Volume 1 is entitled Economic Thought Before Adam Smith, and that's the one I'm going to discuss because it's more nearly related to my own special field of history, which is medieval history. And a second volume called Classical Economics. Now, like Alex Chofin's work, but in a broader chronological context, Rothbard explores the interplay of moral philosophy, theology, canon law, and the historic emergence of what we call free market economics. Rothbard's interest in the history of economic theories in Western culture came from his early adoption of Thomism and the idea of natural law as the framework for his own personal exploration of economics. In contrast to many earlier Austrian economists who did not utilize natural law doctrines, Rothbard made them the underlying structure of his economic analysis. In his middle years, he was drawn to the thesis that moral philosophy and Christian theology have been at the root of modern economic theory. He was drawn in this direction by works in other areas. Clarence Carrier, for example, a professor out at the University of Illinois, had written a wonderful book on the American psychological profession, a biographical approach in which he showed that almost all of the key psychological theorists were the sons of ministers, and that though these psychologists generally abandoned formal Christianity, in fact, their psychological theories were expressions of their underlying theological backgrounds. Arthur Wittig from the New School did a similar study of American sociologists and found the same pattern, that a modern sociological theory seems to be rooted in a kind of Christian theological framework, but one highly secularized to take account of the modern secular academy. Likewise, there was the Kleppner thesis, which traced the voting patterns in the 19th century political party systems, literally precinct by precinct, and found a remarkable conjunction between the presence of what Kleppner calls liturgical churches, Catholics, Anglicans, and the Democratic Party strength, as against the evangelicals or pietists who tended to favor the Republican Party. Well, Rothbard was fascinated by this and began to say, well, let's look at the economic doctrines coming out of our American economist and our European economist, and do we have there a kind of shadow in the secular area of theological prescriptions? Now, in his middle years, he was drawn to this thesis and began a very long and close study of the biographies of the major economists of the modern world since 1500, and the extensive study of the intellectual milieu in which they were raised, educated, and their works were published. These two volumes then constitute the result of his findings. It was not long before Murray began to realize that you couldn't start in 1500 or 1600, and certainly you couldn't start with Adam Smith. And the opening line of his new book, which I think is waving a flag at the multiculturalist in a way, he says, as usual, it all begins with the Greeks. So he moves from that point on. But to plunge into the center of the first volume, he talks about the monumental breakthroughs in economic thought by the Franciscan friars of all people in the 13th and 14th century. The friars were deeply involved in defending their own religious vows of total poverty against those in the church who were opposed to this viewpoint. They explore the whole field of economic phenomenon in the process of arguing for their theological views on poverty. One of Rothbard's great heroes in the book is Friar Peter John Olivi, 1248-1298, who he finds was the first to confront the famous paradox of value. And Murray, I'll quote Murray, which would confound Adam Smith and the classical economist and do far better than they at solving it. Utility in the determination of price is relative, not absolute, taught Olivi in the 13th century. Thus discovering the concept of subjective utility, and he then went on to also create the idea of capital as a fund of money invested in a business venture and permitting the use of money in a fruitful way to gain a profit. We might be say, well, what's so spectacular about that? But you have to remember that almost all economic thought in the medieval schools was based upon two problems that the medieval theologians had. One was the question of usury, and the other was the question of what is the just price. And in the effort to deal with these concepts realistically and yet at the same time in accordance with justice and theological teachings, they in fact began an intensive study of economic action, actually encouraging the most intimate technical knowledge to develop about the actual workings of the economy. In other words, here's a perfect example of moral problems leading to the development of scientific knowledge of the economy. Another point of vigorous discussion was the nature of property rights. While Aquinas argued that neither private nor communal property was a necessary feature of the natural state of nature, the Franciscan John Duns Scotus argued that in the state of nature, all resources were held in common, so that private property or dominion had only conventional and artificial or socially accepted basis. There was no natural right to property. In this state of primitive communism, anyone could take what he needed from the common store. This issue was settled by Pope John XXII in 1329 when he issued a papal bull decreeing that property rights were rooted in man's nature as created by divine law. Property rights were therefore natural and coextensive with man's actions in the material world. This viewpoint, as I'm sure you'll understand, was crucial in the subsequent development of capitalism and the theories of property rights, concept of property rights. And all of this came about because of, essentially, disputes about canon law or disputes about Christian theology or moral philosophy. Now, Rothbard argues that most modern accounts of the history of economic thought, Schumpeter is a notable exception, began their accounts with Adam Smith or the physiocrats with a side glance at the mercantilist. But particularly from the 1950s and 60s on, the work of medieval historians such as Judge John Noonan and Marjorie Grice Hutchins and the late Raymond DeRuver and my friend Dr. Chofin opened the gate to reveal that the medieval and Christian roots of modern economic doctrine are at the roots of modern economic doctrine. Rothbard sees emerging from the works of the late scholastic canonists and theologians an economic doctrine anticipating the economic ideas of late 19th and 20th century Austrian theorists. Rothbard writes from an Austrian perspective. The rediscovery of these remarkable Christian economic innovators, almost without exception, priests, bishops, friars, writing before 1500, offers a rich field for reclaiming the Christian moral foundations of modern economic science. It was in attempting to solve moral and ethical problems that these canonists and theologians were drawn to understand more clearly what precisely governed economic transactions and economic phenomena like money, markets, and prices. In other words, the contribution here of these moral theologians started with the concept of sin and justice. And out of that zeal for understanding what is sinful and understanding what justice requires, they in fact evolved, according to Rothbard, an almost modern theory of economic freedom. Now, the second book I want to recommend to you is Dr. Evans' book, The Theme is Freedom. Complementing Rothbard's exposition of the Christian roots of the economic foundations of a free society, Evans has recently published a masterly study of the biblical and medieval roots of American political institutions and the seminal ideas that compose our traditional political philosophy. Filled with striking quotations from a host of theologians, lawyers, political philosophers, moral philosophers, statesmen, historians, and so on, Evans quickly moves us from page to page, inspiring and persuading us with the lofty ideas and arguments which have promoted the idea of freedom over many centuries. To one like myself who taught Western civilization for over 30 years, Evans' book is distinguished not only for its breadth and scholarship, but its perceptive exposition of key elements of the story. He boldly, and I say again, he boldly asserts that the, quote, ancients knew nothing of our ideas of limited government and personal liberty. And given their peculiar conception of the world, they could not have done so. He then discounts the significance of Aristotle in shaping our concept of freedom, and rightly, I believe, places Plato as the father of all authoritarianism in the West. Evans argues rightly, I believe, that the sources of our tradition of liberty lie in the worldview of the Bible and in the theology of the Christian Church. Evans traces the Christian tradition that the state's power is limited, that kings and peoples are bound by contract, that the state is confined by law and by the consent of the governed, These ideas have their origins not de novo in the minds of the founding fathers of America, but are rooted in the whole political tradition of the medieval of medieval Christendom. They did not disappear with the breakup of the medieval church in the 16th century, but reappeared again and again in the political debates of both Protestants and Catholics, in the struggle to grapple with the growing absolutism of the state that we associate with the Renaissance and the 17th century. For example, the slogans, "Government by laws, not men," is as old as the medieval cry that taxation without representation is tyranny. Both of these slogans are rooted in a medieval understanding of a correct political order. The other cry, "The voice of the people is the voice of God," was already popular when it is first recorded in writing, unfavorably I should add, by Alcuin of York, the minister to Charlemagne, in the year 798. This book is so excellent that I can commend it very highly to you. It fulfills brilliantly the first task that we must undertake to reclaim the moral foundations of our civilization. It tells us the scope and the details of the struggle over many centuries to define freedom and to create laws and institutions that can widen it and protect it. Now, we've not always been very successful at this task of protecting and widening freedom. The road of history is never a straight line. The rise of absolutism in the post-medieval period, the inroads of secularization in law, the abandonment of Christianity by many of the intellectual elites, the neo-paganism stemming from the rationalistic Enlightenment, and the revival of paganism and occultism in the 19th and 20th centuries, all of these have taken their toll on that tradition of freedom, and Dr. Evans addresses all of these questions in his book. Evans also points out that the creation of totalitarianism takes place essentially in an anti-Christian intellectual atmosphere, and that the satanic cultures of our contemporary world are also explicitly anti-Christian. Evans has performed a great service in calling to our minds these historical roots of our American libertarian civilization. He also mentions at one time something that really warmed my heart, because it's a view I've taken myself in classes, that America is the last great bastion of medievalism, that our political system is almost, in its best forms, is almost always a reflection of medieval political principles. And part of this is due, of course, to the fact that England itself hardly became a modern state until the 20th century. For our friends from Latin America, they will be very aware of the question that has bothered them. Why did the English-speaking countries of the Americas go in a different direction than the Spanish-speaking countries? And I personally believe it has to do with the fact that Spain became a modern state while England did not. By a modern state, I mean one that was highly centralized and absolutist in its forms of government. Now, since I understand from our hostess this morning that some controversy is expected on occasions like this, I will offer some further comment by way of extending Dr. Evans' analysis. I was greatly cheered by his including the biblical story of the founding of the Hebrew kingship. He quotes a long passage from 1 Samuel on the woes that will come with the institution of kingship by God at man's demand. In other words, man demands kingship The Hebrews demand kingship from God so they can be like their neighbors. Very common phenomenon. And God says, well, all right, but I'll give you kingship, but you have to remember what goes with it. Conscription of your young men, conscription of your young women, and taxes on all of your property. And here we are, still suffering from these things. But I would suggest that there are further additions to that biblical understanding of the nature of the state, New Testament understandings, which I think that Dr. Evans did not fully develop. Can anyone forget that the temptations offered by Satan to Christ was possession of all the kingdoms of the world if Christ would fall down and worship him? From this comes the thoroughly Christian idea that the kingdoms of this world are the property of the prince of darkness, of Satan. They're not some bounty given to us by God. They are demonic. To Christians, political entities then are instruments of Satan. They are not divine boons. The effort to control and limit the state, to preserve freedom, is part of our religious duty to resist the demonic forces within all societies. Can any 20th century person doubt the demonic character of the state, any state? Or can we forget the model of passive resistance to the state in Peter's response to the chief priest in Jerusalem that it was better to obey God rather than men? Or can we forget the thousands of early Christians who accepted death rather than worship a living divine emperor? Or the millions of Christians and Jews in the 20th century who have been victims of the organized hatred of modern totalitarian states? Now, the early church, through its first three centuries, was profoundly free because it existed outside the control of the Roman monarchy. We have to remember at all times Christianity begins as an outlaw band, not as part of the normal society. Then that changed. Constantine, at the beginning of the 4th century, converts to Christianity, and through his conversion begins the effort to assimilate the church within the Roman state. Constantine was so bold as to call himself the Vicar of Christ, a title which I believe, as a Catholic, was much more appropriately held by the Bishop of Rome. To my mind, the most significant contribution of the church to the cause of freedom can be found in a single document, the letter of Pope Gelasius I in 494 to the Emperor Anastasius. Dr. Evans refers to this letter, but I think he doesn't draw the full implications of it. What Gelasius says is there are two spheres of authority, one that of the priest, the divine sphere, the other that of the state, the temple sphere, and that these two are separate and have a equal standing in society. In effect, Gelasius lays down the first principles of separation of church and state. And he does so to ensure the freedom of the church, that the church is not to be encompassed by the world state of Rome, even of Christian Rome. St. Augustine had already described governments as great bands of robbers, and then went on to radically separate Christians from the city of man and to proclaim their true homeland to be the city of God. Skipping some centuries, we come to Pope Gregory VII, the man identified with the so-called Gregorian Reform movement. Now, Gregory threw down the gauntlet to secular rulers who threatened to capture the church for their own political reasons, purposes. Gregory, in a letter to the Bishop of Metz, made his view of the state quite clear. He says, "Who does not know that kings and princes derive their origin from men ignorant of God, men who raise themselves above their fellows by pride, plunder, treachery, murder, in short, by every kind of crime, at the instigation of the devil, the prince of this world, men blind with greed and intolerable in their audacity." Who knows, someday we may see those words published in the editorials of the Wall Street Journal. This leads me to address the problem that Dr. Evans has struggled with for many years, the problem of classical liberals, conservatives, and libertarians of all stripes, and the possibilities of something he called fusionism. I suggest that the most significant point of distinction among all of the above groups is whether they are pro-state or anti-state. I doubt we shall see the end of the state this side of the second coming of Christ. But certainly, libertarians and most conservatives ought to be basic allies in the unending, I stress that, the unending war to control and limit the state. The notion that the state should be, quote, in the business of instilling virtue is rightly deemed ludicrous by Dr. Evans. There's a quotation from an Irish historian, John McNeill, writing in the early part of this century. McNeill was not only a classical liberal, but he was one of the leading patriots in the War of Independence in Ireland. And this has always inspired my understanding of the problems of being a historian. McNeill says, speaking of the prejudices of historians, "The worship of success, the worship of bigness, the worship of the state, we may say in short, the worship of the beast and his image. It is in the spirit of this abasement that the history of Roman power has been written, and no historian has yet faced the other side of the picture, the amount of steamrolling of humanity that went to make up the Pax Romana." These sentiments, it seems to me, apply equally to America and to many contemporary intellectual leaders, and even some calling themselves conservatives. I cannot imagine Christ needing any state to bring salvation to anyone or to impose virtue on any community. I think it is blasphemous to think of it. If fusionism is a viable political position, in my opinion, it must be founded upon a vigorous and vigilant and persistent hostility to anything that strengthens the power of the state. This is the tradition that Dr. Evans so ably describes in his book, The Theme of Freedom, Is Freedom. It is a position to which all men, striving to live virtuously, should rally regardless of how they label themselves in the contemporary political scene. Thank you.